Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katsimatidis rubs shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katsimatidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katsimatidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the New York edition of the Cats Roundtable. We have a great show for you today. We have Dick Morris. He knows what's going on in Washington, and he's going to let us know. And we have Steve Cates. When you look up in the sky, what are we going to see? Steve Moore, one of the top five economists. And an exclusive, we have former Governor David Paterson up in Albany on a meetings going on and what's going on in Albany. Governor?
Well, the Assembly has suspended the impeachment hearings that they're having against Governor Andrew Cuomo. And they will suspend them on the day that he leaves, which will be August 24th.
So unless he steps out the door, they won't suspend.
Right. Now, the reason for this is that the legal opinion that they got is that you cannot impeach an elected official that's already out of office. So they will keep the committee going theoretically just in ceremony, but on the 24th, when he leaves, they will drop their investigations. He did point out that they did find criminal conduct in the investigations, and so that will be for district attorneys or, you know, other law enforcement officials to address.
Governor, it's Richard Weinberg. How are you?
Your Honor, how are you?
I'm fine. So based on what I've read, you have two other issues. They say they found some evidence of wrongdoing. One was the misuse of governmental resources to his book. The other was misrepresentation on reports with respect to the nursing home and how they populated a nursing home with COVID people. And those are two outstanding issues, separate and apart from the allegations of the sexual harassment. And they specifically said, they specifically said they're going to refer these to other law enforcement agencies.
So the U.S. attorney is already looking into the latter charge that you mentioned involving the nursing homes. And I'm sure perhaps the local area district attorney will look into the issues regarding the misuse of public resources in the writing of the book. So this is probably disappointing to some of the members of the Assembly who really wanted to see Governor Cuomo answer for a lot of things that they feel that he did. But I think overall it is correct that it's hard to impeach someone who's already out of office. Oh, impeachment ideas to get them out of office.
Hey, David, Vito Fisella, in your crystal ball, what do you see happening on these other investigations, say 6 months or a year from now? What do you think happens?
Well, I think the issue of the nursing homes is going to be very difficult for them because they even have evidence that they told legislators why they didn't comply, which... you know, just because you don't like who the president is, you don't like who the U.S. attorney is, that doesn't give you the right to not answer their subpoenas or to in any way change the statistics from where they actually were. And the attorney general had reported on that earlier in the year. So I see that as a real problem. With the book, the difficult thing is they said that the employees did this on their personal time. Well, when you work for an elected official, there's no overtime. Mm. So anything that you do for that person is part of your personal time. Now, we have a strict rule about, you know, campaigning that can be done on someone's personal time. You have to take time off to do it. So unless they show that someone took a leave of absence to help write this book, and by the way, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the book. The book is huge. It looks like a reference book. So, you know, it was hard to put that together over a couple of months and then release it. Had to take the work of a whole lot of people. So I don't know that the penalties will be as severe there, but I do think that they are going to have to overcome some evidence to the contrary.
Tell us, has Kathy Hochul tried to call you? And you know, I mean, you were a lieutenant governor, and you went into the governor's spot to get any tips on how you did it versus how she's going to do it?
We've had some conversations. There are some differences in our situation. When I became governor, the budget was due in 13 days. So I was under a tremendous amount of pressure, and I hadn't been as involved in my second year as lieutenant governor as I had been in my first year. That was very difficult. She, on the other hand, will not be in office when the legislature is in session, unless she calls a special session, until January of 2022. So she has time to really pick who she wants to be her staff, to really decide which policies she wants to continue from the previous administration and which ones that are unique to her point of view that she would like to implement. She also has time to go and meet with all the legislators, not just the ones in the majority parties, but even the minority, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. They were all sent there by the people of New York. And Hochul has the type of personality that can talk to anybody and wants to hear information from people. I think she is going to really surprise New Yorkers by how effective she is. She's a moderate to a certain degree, but on the issues that are really important, I think that she comes down on the right side.
Governor Patterson, thank you for the exclusive of what's going on in Albany, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you, John, and take care, everybody else, and have a great weekend. There.
Where are we? Economy. Well, stock market looks like it's going to go on forever. One of the top five economists in our country, we have with us Stephen Moore. Stephen Moore, tell us what's going on.
Well, good to be with you, John. This is an important weekend because it was 40 years ago this weekend that Ronald Reagan signed into law his very famous and at that time very controversial across-the-board tax cut that many of us, including Larry Kudlow and Art Laffer and Steve Forbes and you and I, believe had a huge impact in rebuilding the American economy from the wreckage of the 1970s. And you know, you mentioned the stock market at an all-time high today, which is fantastic news. You know, it's incredible because the day before Ronald Reagan implemented his tax cut, the Dow Jones 40 years ago was at a little under 1,000 points. Today, here we are 40 years later, it's at 35,000 points. So this has been an incredible period of wealth creation for our country. No other nation in the history of the world has seen anything like what's happened in America. And I do think it was really launched by Reaganomics, by the lower taxes and less regulation, the pro-free enterprise and pro-free trade direction of the country. And I say that, John, it's not just history, but it's important because when I look at the Biden agenda that they're going to try to pass this fall, I see a lot of policies that are completely contrary to Reaganomics, going back to 1970s. Style re-regulation of the economy and 1970s tax rates. So let's hope that doesn't happen, but it's an amazing story what happened 40 years ago.
Well, Stephen Moore, I tell jokes sometimes, and the joke I tell is right now, like in New York, people are going to be paying almost a 70% tax. I jokingly say Putin will give you a better deal, but Putin will be 50-50.
You know, it's only half of a joke. I mean, it's so sad that that's the situation. But, you know, if we pass the Biden tax increase, the United States, John, will have higher taxes than Russia and China. Now, I have a problem with that. I don't think that's a very good way to compete with our, you know, major competitors and in many cases our adversaries. And so it is a dangerous situation. I want to mention one other thing that happened this week, John, that really bothered me, and it may have bothered you as well, and that is, you know, the White House, Joe Biden, basically went hand in hat to the OPEC countries, Saudi Arabia, and pleaded with them to raise their oil output because they want to bring the price of gasoline down. And I couldn't believe this. It was so, first of all, it was so embarrassing to have an American president, you know, beg the Saudis to increase their oil production. But if we want more oil in the world, why don't we produce it here at home? Why are we not building pipelines?
Listen,
why are we not allowing drilling
100%
on, you know, federal lands?
Stephen Moore, yeah. Donald Trump had the oil up to 14 million gallons, barrels a day. At $50 a barrel. The Saudi Arabians say, well, we'll sell you plenty of oil, at $70 or $75 a barrel. I mean, that's a tax on the American people.
It is, you know, and you mentioned, I think you said we reached, what, 14 million
14,
barrels?
14, I think 13.7, 13.8, I'm not sure, but yeah, almost 14.
But we're now,
and we're down
now. And now we're down to about 11.5. So we've cut up, we're reducing our oil production at the same time we're pleading with the Saudis and the Iraqis and Iranians and all these Russians to increase their output. That
we're raising the price.
Reducing this at home.
The price is going up. We're reducing the amount we make and giving the profits to the Saudi Arabians and the OPEC nations. What's in it for us?
That makes no sense. And by the way, how is that going to reduce climate change if we're still using the oil, but we're just using the oil instead of getting it from Texas and Oklahoma and West Virginia and North Dakota, we're getting it from Siberia and from the Arabian oil fields. So I think Americans were really shocked at that news because we have more oil and gas and coal in this country than any other country in the world. I mean, we have
100 years of oil between Canada and the United States, our sister country.
That's right. And by the way, coal, we have 500 years worth of coal, and we have about 300 years of natural gas. And the idea that we should keep it in the ground and then buy it from these other countries, it seems to me, I mean, I didn't always agree with everything Donald Trump did. As you know, I helped advise him on the economy, and we would argue sometimes. And I mostly agree with him, but many times I would disagree with him. But I always felt, John, with Donald Trump, that even when I disagreed with his decision, and he was the president, obviously, he made the decisions, that he was always trying to put America first. And, I sometimes scratch my head and I wonder, you know, is this president really putting America's economic interests first? And I see what's happening with our oil production, and I'm not so sure about it.
You're 100% right. We'll talk, Steve Moore, we listen to you every Saturday between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock for more money. And God bless you and WABCRadio.com. And we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thanks, John. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You're a great American. You're a classic example of the people who built this country.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
This is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's John Catsimatidis.
Sunday. Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Katzmann here. And it's a long, hot weekend. What do we do? Well, if it's a cool evening, we go outside and we look at the sky, and there's so many beautiful stars. And to tell us about it, we have Dr. Sky with us today, otherwise known as Steve Cates. Steve?
Good morning, John. Good to be with you and the listeners. What a beautiful introduction as we move into the deep, hot humidity of summer, but still many things to see in our skies, John. And we top it off with talking about this Perseid meteor shower. And take it from me, John, maybe like other people, I was just out this morning looking in our Arizona skies here. And by the way, I don't want people to get the wrong idea that many places in Arizona have super dark skies, but here in the Phoenix metro area, we have the same kind of light pollution that people in the New York area or any other large city. But the good news is I was out there, like many people, just with the naked eye, John. I was seeing meteors, not hundreds of them, but I was seeing these things shooting across the sky, and they're all from a comet that passed the Earth. It goes around the sun, I should say, once every 133 years called Swift-Tuttle. So as the listeners right now are hearing this, just simply look into the northeast sky after midnight. If you have a clear sky, there's no moon. You know, John, if you have a clear sky, you may get to see some of this, and it's pretty impressive.
It must be beautiful, and I look forward to it.
Now,
we could see it across the whole country?
Absolutely. And, of course, the obvious understatement is the darker your sky, the better. But here, like I said, in America's fifth largest city, Phoenix, the New York metro area, and other places where your show is heard around the country, people can see this. And here's the important part. Many people just simply say, and it's beautiful and romantic, these are shooting stars. The amazing part about this, John, is that these particles can be the size as small as a piece of the size of a beach, small beach, a grain of beach sand, I should say, upwards to maybe sizes of pebbles in the sky. And some years they pour forth many more meteors than others. But this year, even if it's mild, just to see one is incredible because they're going about 160,000 miles an hour, and they're incinerating about 80 miles above the Earth's surface. Amazing.
80 miles above the Earth's surface.
Oh,
and how far up did, not Elon Musk, how far up did they go when they went up?
Well, they barely touched the surface of space. If you ask everybody about this and the science side, they'll say that, you know, the Elon Musk, of course, is trying to get his spacecraft going. But Richard Branson, they say he went up above 50 miles. But Jeff Bezos went up to about 66 miles into space. And that's not even the height of where the meteors that you'll see in the beautiful nighttime sky.
But what happens at those meteors going at 160,000 miles an hour? Hits those spacecraft.
You know, John, that's a good point. And there actually have been, in the history of space science, there have been instances where micrometeors have actually punctured the hull of spacecraft. And that's a concern. And, you know, especially when you have not only the great solar flares that affect the astronauts and cosmonauts with radiation, but thank goodness, isn't that amazing, for all the stuff that we have in space and all these meteor showers, that nothing catastrophic has happened to date. I think we need to worry more about the space junk that's in low Earth orbit caused by humans.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the movies years ago when the American spacecraft was hit and it was rescued by the Chinese. Now, you know who made that movie? The Chinese paid for that movie.
Absolutely, they did. And it's very interesting because you see movies like this that talk about the impact of what space debris like that. The Chinese obviously have exploded intentionally some of their spacecraft just to see what would happen. Well, that's a bad thing to do. No, 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 because millions of particles, John, of space debris are floating around the Earth. And in that particular movie, of course, when we see this impact on the space station, it's just devastating. It's like being hit by small arms fire from a handgun or a machine gun. And even those sizes that we're talking about are tiny. So they do have the capability of puncturing the hull of spacecraft, and who knows, God forbid, even bringing one down if there's enough of them and they're a little bit larger.
It does sound that that could be one of the most dangerous things about outer space travel.
Yeah.
If you're not knowing, you know, when you have a large cluster of meteorites, we see them as a cluster. But, what, you know, there might be those things running around not being in clusters, and who knows what happens?
Absolutely. And that's why I say, John, some of these meteor showers, well, the good news, let me always start on the positive side of everything. The meteor storm that we get from the Leonids, from the Perseids, and from the Geminids, these meteor showers that happen from the year or throughout the year, none of these particles, at least as far as I know, and I've been studying this a long time, and many people have, none of these really hit the ground. This is interesting. Most of this, if not 99% of it, burns up in the atmosphere. It's just that meteors that are in a classification called bolides, these are like mega fireballs. And what's a bolide? A bolide is a meteor that shines brighter than the full moon. And I've actually seen a few in my life. Maybe some of the listeners have. I actually saw one back in the New York area in the 1960s. And I was sitting out as a young boy watching the sky with my friends and family when, lo and behold, John, out of the northwest sky comes this amazing bright thing shaking across the sky. We heard it sizzle as it went overhead, like you were sizzling bacon in a frying pan. And those type of objects, we know this one, apparently might have struck the ground in somewhere in Canada. But those type of objects are pretty big, like the one that happened in Russia in 2013 called the Chelyabinsk meteor. This was about 66 feet in diameter. And it exploded in Russia. The damage wasn't on the ground. It exploded in the air a few miles high, and it blew windows out in so many businesses and sent about 500 people to the hospital with damage from shrapnel from glass. So let's pray to God that we don't have any of those. But those are the ones, not meteor showers, that actually can be something of contention.
It's mind-boggling. We have 30 seconds left. What would you like to tell all Americans?
I want to mention to everybody, in addition to the meteor shower that you look at, look to the southeast, John. This is the week and next week of Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system. You can see it with the naked eye, and then train those binoculars to it, John. You're going to get to see the satellites that Galileo discovered back in January of 1610. The sky continues to pour forth great things. Look to the right of that by 15, 20 degrees is Saturn. It's a great time to be alive and a great time to share in Arizona and the nation's skies, and particularly on your show, heard around the nation and around the world. People should go out and enjoy the sky. Always remember what? To keep your eyes to the skies.
Steve Cates, thank you so much. God bless you. God bless America. And we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you, John.
And every Sunday we have with us Dick Morris, a strategist, a friend of President Bill Clinton, a friend of Donald Trump. And he's got his ear close to the ground and he knows what the heck is going on. Dick Morris, welcome to Sunday Morning.
Hey, Chick, good to be here.
Tell us, what's the big news today? And you're going to be on WABC Radio at 12 noon
yes.
worldwide and between 12 and 1, WABCRadio.com in New York area, 770 on the AM dial.
Just my address, absolutely. Well, one of the things to talk about on my show, and would love to talk about a little bit here as a preview, is the whole COVID issue and question and the political issue that results is changing dramatically with the new Delta variety of the virus. The fact is that this is a disease of the unvaccinated. The CDC reports that the incidence of the disease among people who have had the shot, have had both shots, is 2 per 100,000 people. And the incidence of people who have not had the shot is 16 out of 100,000 people. So this disease basically affects only the unvaccinated. Most of the vaccinated probably have comorbidities that are accounting for that. And it also is a disease that doesn't kill people. The fatality rate is 1/100th of 1% of those who are infected. 1/100th of 1%. And the hospitalization rate is only 4/100th of 1% of the people who are infected. So we're dealing here with a disease that is preventable. Just get a shot. We're dealing with a disease that is curable. You won't die for the most part. And therefore, why should we all be masked? Why should we close schools? Why should we close businesses? Why should there be all these mandates when this thing is really, at the moment at least, not very dangerous?
Why? And, what's a strategy in scaring the American people all over again?
I think there are two. I think the short-term strategy is that they want everybody to get a shot. So they do not want to tell people that you can still get sick. And they want to urge people to get shots. But I think the basic strategy is political, John. Biden isn't finished spending money yet. He still has large elements of his emergency program that he wants to pass. And it's so evident the emergency is passed. And it's evident in the clinical data, and it's evident in the economic data. But he still needs that sense of crisis, that sense of urgency, to pass $3.5 trillion on a reconciliation package with no Republican votes, including in that amnesty for illegal immigrants, for everybody, 12 million people, who then can become citizens and then can vote, and a whole lot of other stuff he's jamming in there. And if he loses the sense of the emergency, he loses both the legal and the political justification for what he's doing. So he wants to scare
people. Aren't the American people getting... The American people are not so stupid. Aren't they getting mad that he's shipping in all these people from Central America and not testing them, and then not only shipping them in, moving them to other parts of the country untested? And, I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
It's infuriating. It's absolutely outrageous. But the key element here is that I think that this is going to backfire big time on Biden. Because at the beginning of the COVID virus, everybody told us, lock down, close the schools, close your businesses, and wear masks. And we all did. We all obeyed it. We thought it was rational and logical. And we also followed it. I know I did, and most New Yorkers did. Now, at that time, though, there were some people who were conservative Republicans who said, this is crazy, this is paranoid, like include the risks. We should take some of these risks, it's not that bad. And we rejected that point of view. Now the same debate is playing out with a totally different set of facts. The Delta strain is not that serious. It is not that dangerous. It is not worth closing everything for it. But yet the same actors are taking the same position. The Democrats and Biden are saying lock everything down, mandate masks, close schools, make kids, make two-year-olds wear masks, all of that stuff. The same philosophy and the same arguments that prevailed when there was a case for it, and now there's not.
Now, Dick, one more thing.
When you talk about it from the Democrats.
Dick, if not so many people are dying from this particular virus, why aren't we calling it just another flu?
Delta variety is. And I think that the point is that now that it's evident that it's not that serious, by acting it's that serious, they're showing that they're just paranoid, control freak, nanny state liberals.
I don't care about liberal, but it's just common sense. I mean, you know, we had a flu in every year for the last 100 years, and this is flu time again.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, the damage that they've done is incredible. The reading in the math scores is beginning to come out for last year. And Colorado, I just saw, is back to levels that passed in 2013. Other states are also 10 years behind.
Well, Dick Morris, we're out of time, but I'm going to listen to you at 12 noon today on WABCRadio.com in the New York area, 770 on your AM dial. And thank you for bringing the truth out to the American people.
Thank you for having me, Kat.
Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.
Well, he is Greek-American. He's a New Yorker.
It's a great American success story.
He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
He's got plenty of ideas on how to bring change.
Enlist the support of business leaders, elected officials.
Katz and Matidis rub shoulders with some of the most powerful people in the world.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now that's John Katz and Matidis, a native New Yorker.
Mixing common sense thinking with New York sensibility. He's John Katz and Matidis, owner of 77 WABC. And this is the Cats Roundtable on Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, America. This is the national edition of the Cats Roundtable. John Katz Matidis here. It's a great show for you today. We have General David Petraeus. He ran Afghanistan. He will tell us what is really going on. That's an exclusive. We have Gordon Chang tell us what's going on in Asia. We have Mario Cuomo. What's going on in Europe? We also have Father Aristides and Jimmy Petronis from Florida, an update. What's going on in Surfside on that tragic thing in Florida? But without any further ado, let's have Larry Kudlow, our national economist, to tell us what's going on with the economy. Larry, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Tell us, how did Wall Street at an all-time high today?
Profits are booming. Money is easy and free. And until any of this crazy, insane legislation gets passed, the street is in good shape. Stocks are in good shape. Fundamentals are good. We're in a boom. The economy is booming. Consumers are booming. Businesses are booming. Stock market is booming. Unfortunately, inflation is booming. And for all those reasons, for every single one of those reasons, not only if it's not broke, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, this reconciliation or budget resolution package that passed the voterama last night in the Senate is absolutely the worst economic policy imaginable. It is completely divorced from economic conditions. And I might add, polls are starting to show that voters get it. More spending equals inflation, and the middle class is going to shoulder all of the tax hikes proposed by Mr. Biden and Mr. Schumer and Ms. Pelosi. So it's a terrible, that part of it is a terrible story.
Now,
X that out.
There's an open item. There's an open item. And I asked the judge and I asked Ed Cox, who's in the studio with us, if they pass a $3.5 trillion bill and it exceeds the debt limit, Do they need 60 votes to go above the debt limit?
The debt limit can be put into budget reconciliation, or they can suspend the debt limit for as long as they want. And so it's, you know, it's a non-starter. I mean, look, one thing I got to say, it's not a $3.5 trillion package. When the CBO scores this over the 10-year period, which is the window of the budget deal, it will come to over $5 trillion. I don't know how much taxes they're going to ask. It's going to be a minimum of $3 trillion in taxes, and the middle class is going to pay for that, okay, virtually every nickel. But the debt ceiling is not a barrier. It's not an impediment. It is the least of the issues. I think it makes good politics. I had Senator Johnson on our Fox Business show this evening, and he's got 46 Republicans signing a letter saying they're not going to vote for any debt ceiling extensions. But it's of no consequence. It'll be whatever they want it to be.
So with the $3.5 trillion, and
you, $5 trillion plus,
right? Is that going to change the equation? Powell now says that inflation is temporary; it's a supply demand thing. Does that make it more permanent? Or talking about permanent inflation?
It's not going to
seventies all over again.
I don't know if it's the '70s. Actually, it's different than the '70s because the '70s was much more the collapse of the dollar and the end of the Bretton Woods gold dollar exchange system.
I wonder who did that.
But yeah, well, I've written op-eds, but I love you, and I'm not going to talk about that today. And your bride. Look, more spending will put more pressure on the Fed to buy the government debt that will support the spending. It's called monetization. It just means the Fed will buy the bonds and inject even more cash into the economy. We already have more cash than we know what to do with. Literally, banks and money market funds and others are going to the Fed with excess. They want to, here, take our excess cash. And the Fed is taking it for 5 basis points. It's called reverse repurchase agreements. They're trying to drain. They're literally saying, we can't handle this. Our vaults aren't big enough to hold all the excess cash. But on that point, Biden made a very important remark today. He was asked about the Federal Reserve and Jay Powell, and he said, if the Fed deems it appropriate, they will take whatever actions they need to take. Now, that's a loaded statement because it first of all implies that Biden knows inflation is a growing problem.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, his polls are declining, and worker wages are getting hurt by this. Real wages are falling. Secondly, he's, I think, pulling a Kamala Harris here. So remember, he put Kamala Harris in charge of immigration at the border, and she did one heck of a job, right? We haven't heard from her since. He's basically saying today that Jay Powell and the Fed is the cause of inflation, and that they're going to take the burden, not me. It's their problem, not my problem. Now, to some extent, it is the Fed's problem, by the way. But to a greater extent, all the spending and deficits and debt will put the pressure on the Fed, as I said, to monetize. So there's a front page story there, how he's trying to transfer the
And he made a statement this afternoon. He says it's going to be paid by the rich Americans and the rich corporations.
The Joint Tax Committee, which does all the tax analysis, and the Congressional Budget Office have both said that corporate taxes are paid by the middle class. In fact, the latest Joint Tax Committee is nearly 70% of corporate taxes are paid by people earning $500,000 or less. And the bulk of that group is not 500,000. The bulk of that group, you know, is probably 50, 75,000 to 200,000, because that's where the money is. You know, Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. It's the middle class that have the money. The top 1% doesn't have the money. They may be wealthy and successful, and God bless them. And he's not going to fool anybody. Corporations don't pay taxes. People pay taxes. Right.
Because the corporations reflect it back to the consumer.
That's right. And
that's plain and simple.
Think of it this way. You taxing a business, that means the business will have lower profits. Okay? That means they'll have fewer profits to grant wages to the workforce, to grant build new plants and equipment and technology so productivity is high. That means their profits won't be there for the stock market investors, and the share prices will go down. You're going to get – if this thing passes, the stock market will get slammed. And finally, they have to pass on the higher tax costs to consumers.
Absolutely.
In the form of higher consumer prices. And people – Rasmussen, Scott Rasmussen, one of the best pollsters in the business, just came out. He was on our Fox Business show this evening, and he said 60-61% of the middle class believes they will pay the higher taxes.
Absolutely.
The voters are smarter than the politicians.
What is today is Gordon Chang, and his Twitter handle, at Gordon G. Chang. Sign up to his Twitter handle. Gordon Chang, good morning on Sunday morning. What the heck is going on?
Well, China is a mess. They've got twin problems internally. One of them is the flooding, which is getting worse and worse. And the other is the Delta variant. There was the outbreak that they say started on July 20. Now has spread to most of the country, including the big cities like Beijing. China has really no answer to it. So it's got two internal problems, and it doesn't really have the ability to deal with either of them right now.
You know, they let it loose. You know, God punishes. You know, they let it loose on the world. They protected themselves from the original COVID-19. They let it loose on Europe. They let it loose on the United States and didn't tell anybody. Now, I guess it's payback time. What else do you think you could tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, people around the world have been talking about karma when it comes to China and COVID-19. It appears that it started in a lab in Wuhan. But the one thing we know, John, is that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, took steps in 2019 and early 2020 to release this virus on the world. He lied about contagiousness. He knew it was highly contagious, told the world it was not. And then while he was locking down his own country, he was pressuring other countries not to impose travel restrictions and quarantines on arrivals from China. And it was those arrivals that spread this disease around the world. It should not have left China. Right now, it's come back, and Beijing has had a zero COVID policy, but the bug doesn't respect it.
I guess worldwide, it's a big problem. I mean, what are the Chinese doing? Have they isolated their cities from travel?
Yes, they've employed the draconian methods that they started with in Wuhan in 2019, which means that, for instance, they say there was only one case of COVID in a worker at the Ningbo port. But they shut down that facility, which is the third largest container port in the world. Now, I tend to think that there were more than just one infection, but this is what they do. And also, there's mass testing. So, for instance, in Nanjing, which is where China says the Delta variant entered the country, some people have been tested three times. Some people have been tested nine times. So it's a method of just trying to overpower the disease, which is not working. And Chinese propaganda is now starting to signal that they're going to have to move away from their zero COVID policies.
Now, in addition, last week, was it they sentenced a Canadian citizen for 11 years?
Yes, this was just a couple days ago. This is Michael Spavor. He's a Canadian. He was detained just a couple days after Canadian authorities detained Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei Technologies, at the request of the United States, which filed an extradition request. China has grabbed two Michaels, two Canadians, Michael Spavor, the one you referred to, and Michael Korvig, and they are awaiting their fates. They also took a Canadian drug smuggler, somebody who was convicted and given a 15-year sentence, and then gave him, in addition, a death penalty, which has just been confirmed. So they're going after Canadians as hostage diplomacy. And this says, John, that China is not safe for foreigners, especially not safe for Canadians, but certainly not safe for Americans either.
Is anybody traveling to China? What's tourism from the United States?
Tourism from every place is down to almost zero. There is some business travel, but China has been locking down air travel, and this is a COVID measure. So there isn't very much travel these days, but I believe that Americans should not be staying in China, given the nature of China's attacks on the U.S.
If we have another minute or so left, if you were to give advice to Americans
I guess the first one is stay out of China. And the second one is I play this jingle on radio in the afternoon sometimes. See the USA in a Chevrolet. Do you remember that old song?
I have a Chevy Cruze, John. I love my car, and we do see the USA in it because we travel around. We try to stay off the planes as much as possible. So when we have to go somewhere, most of the time we drive. And yes, they should stay out of China. They should also stay out of Hong Kong. And whether you drive a Chevy or not, this is a great time to tour our country.
Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, thank you so much for coming on and always letting the American people know what's going on.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
Telling it like it is, giving you both sides of the story with common sense thinking. It's the Cats Roundtable.
This is the Cats Roundtable. It's on Cats Roundtable. Here's Sunday morning. What a mess we have in our hands in Afghanistan. Well, the number one guy that knows what really is going on is retired General David Petraeus. David Petraeus served our country for 37 years, and he still puts his two cents in to make sure our country runs well, and a former CIA director. Good morning, General. How are you this morning?
Good, John. Thanks. How are you?
I am well. I am worried about our friends in Afghanistan. I am worried about our what the heck is going on there. We spent 20 years there, and we're going to lose everything. What's your evaluation?
Well, this is an absolute tragedy that is becoming worse with each passing day. Sadly, it is a nightmare for the Afghan people and our partners for 20 years. It clearly has to be assessed as a setback for the United States, for our allies, who, as you noted, spent 20 years there. And it's becoming a humanitarian catastrophe on top of everything else. So it's a very, very dire, very sad, nightmarish situation. And you look, John, you'll recall I said in the very beginning that I feared that we would regret this decision. And I fear that that has become realized. And much of this was predictable and, frankly, preventable. If we had been willing to maintain the very modest number of troops that we had there, 3,500, that kept 8,500 coalition forces there. It kept 18,000 contractors there who maintained the sophisticated U.S.-provided helicopters and Air Force aircraft that are trying to support the Afghan forces. And we very rapidly and frankly hastily withdrew that and our close air support and our drones and all the rest that used to enable the Afghan security forces. And as I feared would happen and stated this, if you pull those contractors out, the operational readiness of that Afghan Air Force was going to degrade fairly quickly. And if you're an Afghan soldier out in a far-flung location and the Taliban are conducting a simultaneous offensive in numerous locations all around the country, you'll fight for a couple of days, 3 days. And if you start to realize that there are no forces coming to the rescue, there's no resupply, there's no air medevac, and there's no close air support, eventually, you're going to conclude that your situation is doomed, and tragically, you'll do what Afghan forces have been doing, which is either surrender, flee, desert, or what have you. And then this becomes psychological. What you have then is it starts in one or two places. Others see it happening. They start to wonder what is going to happen to us. And then you see the whole organization just start to collapse. And tragically, we have even seen some of the most important warlords in Herat, for example, where the warlord was galvanizing the people and the Afghan forces, must have also concluded that the situation was untenable and has surrendered. So again, you have hundreds of thousands, probably millions of individuals fleeing the advances of the Taliban. You see predictably barbaric Taliban activities, not quite as horrifically so as ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but on a considerable magnitude.
I hear the Taliban are executing a lot of their prisoners.
They're certainly not observing the rules of laws of land warfare, to put it mildly, the Geneva Convention. And again, all of that should have been expected. Senator McConnell, I believe it was, said that this was predictable and preventable. In fact, a massive predictable and preventable disaster. And sadly, I have to conclude that is a correct assessment. So again, this is a really tragic development and situation. Now, you know, we pulled out 3,500 troops. We're actually now deploying 8,000. About 3,500 will go into Kabul. But I don't know where they're even going to be. You know, Kabul is packed with refugees, people trying to get out of the country. The airfield is actually very modest in size compared to the two enormous ones we gave up in Kandahar and Bagram. So I don't even, how do you put aircraft on the ground, refueling, maintenance, medical facilities, because you're not going to put 3,500 troops in a war zone without adequate medical care, but literally just food, fuel, water, ablution units, et cetera, because this is not out in the middle of the field. You're in the middle of the city. It's going to be very, very challenging for the logisticians. And perhaps there can be some kind of deal cut with the Taliban that, you know, if you guys allow us to withdraw, then we won't come after you with our air power. But ultimately, you'll see, presumably, you'll see Kabul fall or Kabul capitulate. Either of those outcomes is horrible for our national interests and, frankly, for our image around the world as well. I mean, we...
So who would ever back up our troops again, help from any country we're in the way we have treated them?
I think that is a reasonable question. Do you really want to be a partner? All of this is just so, again, tragic and regrettable. And frankly, was not just predictable, but individuals did lay this out. If you look at the bipartisan commission, it was chartered by Congress, which included a former commander in Afghanistan, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joe Dunford, had the former Obama Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Michelle Flournoy, former senator from New Hampshire. Again, they warned, you know, in a worst case, this is what could happen. As opposed to, again, just maintaining 3,500 troops. And yes, it's a stalemate. And yes, you cannot prevail. You have to get over the fact that you cannot win in Afghanistan because the enemy has sanctuaries outside your reach, beyond your reach in Pakistan. And the Pakistanis would not eliminate these sanctuaries from their soil. So the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, et cetera, had their senior leaders, their senior headquarters, their senior logistics facilities outside our area of influence. But that's not to say you couldn't have managed. You certainly could have prevented what we see unfolding before us so tragically right now.
That, you know, it's just horrible. And you're the one that's been there. You ran that place. So you're the one that knows what the heck is going on. And I thank you for reflecting it to the American people because they have to know the truth.
To be with you.
Thank you so much. What advice would you give the President of the United States if you were standing next to him in the Oval Office?
Well, I think it is time for a true assessment, the time to speak truth to power, to acknowledge. The other day, you may recall the response to a question about what was going on in Afghanistan was no regrets. Well, clearly there has to be an assessment of how catastrophic this development is for the United States, and understandably how difficult it would be to both, number one, acknowledge that, and number two, reverse this. But, you know, that's what the so-called rational actor model would call for. Recognizing I got the politics of this thing and how difficult that would be. But this unfolding tragedy, disaster, is going to get worse unless we take serious action to prevent it. Yes, we need to evacuate our citizens and our embassy employees and others, but what happens then? Are we then going to allow, you know, so maybe the Taliban halt the offensive for the time that we are allowed to do that, or that takes to do that. Do we then just go back to, it's up to the Afghans and Afghan leaders, and allow the country to totally collapse? Again, I think it's time for a very, very cold-eyed assessment of what has unfolded, and then a reversal of the decisions that have led to it.
Well, General Petraeus, thank you for everything you've done for our country and continue to do for our country.
It was a privilege.
God bless you and God
thank
bless
you, John.
America.
Okay.
This is the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back.
Here's the man who is New York, exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Catsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Katzmann here. Sunday morning. What's going on in Europe? With us this morning is a good friend. His name is Mario Economo. He's a former banker who has worked in New York, London, Zurich, and with large money central banks. And I'm asking him for a report. What's going on in Europe? Good morning, Mario. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Katzmann. I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for having me back on the show again.
Well, there's so many things going on in the United States. We always ask our friends to talk to us about Europe, talk to us about Asia. It's your turn. Give us a report. What's going on in Europe?
Right. So I think that the most pressing issue right now in Europe is the weather and the rather extreme weather conditions with respect to heat in the Mediterranean countries and the forest fires that have resulted from these incredible heat wave. To give you an idea, temperatures in many of the Mediterranean countries this past week have reached around 115 to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is highly unusual, and there has been a severe drought accompanying this, and this has resulted in massive forest fires that have broken out across the region.
And where are the major fires? There's major fires in Greece. Tell us about it. How bad?
So there are fires right now in Italy. There are the worst fires by far are the ones in Greece. In fact, they were so severe and extreme that Greece reached out and roughly 24 countries sent firefighters, fire equipment, as well as airplanes and helicopters to assist in the effort to put the fires out. The level of fires that Greece has seen are unprecedented. It is a large ecological disaster. We have seen the north of Evia, the island of Evia, completely burnt. The amount of acres that we're talking are phenomenal. And the problem is, when these regions burn the way they have, it takes years for the trees to grow again. Unfortunately, many of the people who live in those areas are farmers. They live off of the land. They live off of the trees. They have animals. They have livestock. And in a lot of instances, villages burnt, trees burnt, animals burnt, and these people have lost not only their homes, but their livelihood. So the government has to act quickly to provide immediate relief. But there's a longer-term problem, and that is one of migration within a country, because people now are homeless. And also, what are they going to do with respect to their livelihood? A tree can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years to actually grow and bear fruit. So what do these people do for the next 5 to 10 years? Not to mention the infrastructure. There were extreme power failures across Greece where these fires were occurring in the Peloponnese and on the island of Evia. When you don't have electricity, the pumps don't work. If the pumps don't work, you don't have water. If you don't have water, you don't have plumbing. So there's a domino effect of destruction, and it has created for a very, very unpleasant environment. For the most part, Italy is coping with the fires much better. There are fires also, in fact, in Algeria, which is interesting because most people think Algeria has desert, but it does have mountains with trees, and there's fires there as well. There are fires as well in Turkey, although they do have a handle on them. The Greeks finally have been able to get control of the forest fires, but that is really largely a result of massive amounts of help, like I said, that came in. To give you an idea, even
Where
Russia...
Where did it come from?
Okay, so there's roughly 24 countries, and I'm not going to list them all because I don't remember them all, and I should, but I can tell you there's been a large contingent of help that's come in from Romania, Serbia, Croatia, Slovakia, the Czech Republic.
Mario, I had heard that they asked Germany for help, and Germany did not volunteer?
Yeah, so initially Germany said they were unable to provide any assistance in the form of airplanes because they don't have any. But when the French sent assistance, as did the English, the Germans also sent firefighters as well as fire trucks. I have to tell you, though, that the most impressive operation I saw with people on the ground were the people from the Balkan countries, the Serbians, the Romanians. They came in, the Romanians came in with such discipline, with such beautiful fire trucks. I mean, you should see these machines they have. And I'm questioning why the Greeks don't have these types of machines. But you should see the machines they have. The Greeks were cheering them. When they showed up, they were putting fires out.
Let's move on and talk about the COVID crisis in Europe. How bad is it?
Well, the COVID crisis in Europe, I would say, is not any worse or any better than what it is here in the United States. At the moment, Europe itself is going through another wave. The cases are slowly starting to spike, but that was expected because the borders were open so that people could travel around for the summer vacation. People now are on summer vacation, and it's anticipated that at the end of August we will see an increase in cases. People are vaccinated for the most part. Hospital admissions overall are not what they were in the previous waves, and ICU admissions are far lower than they were in the previous waves as well. So I think that with
but
respect
the United
to COVID,
States has issued the United States has issued a level four for Greece, a level three for Hungary. Let me see what else. France, a level four for France, and level three for Finland, level three for Estonia, level three for Denmark, level two for Czechoslovakia. And I understand Israel is having a problem, and they're already administering an additional vaccine or booster?
Well, from what I understand, yes, they are administering a booster shot, but it's starting for people who had taken the vaccine early in the year and also for the people that are in certain groups that are more prone to getting ill, severely ill.
Understood.
From COVID.
We got one more minute. The economy. Do you see any improvement in the European economy?
Yes, overall I do. Europe has just finally authorized that 750 billion euro package that the European Union is actually going to be providing and borrowing and providing money for the first time under the umbrella of the EU. That's positive. That money has started being distributed. In fact, Greece received the first tranche of that money at the end of July. And I think overall the mood is positive. I think people are ready to move on with their lives. And I'm relatively optimistic, both in Europe and the United States, that we will see good growth figures. Inflation is a bit of a problem. You do mention that every week on your show. You are right. But the issue is this going to be a longer-term inflation, or will supply chains catch up and therefore smooth things out? Personally, I believe supply chains will catch up, and I think that this will be a temporary blip. But overall, people are ready to go out. They're ready to spend their money. They have money. And the job market, generally speaking, tends to be, considering the crisis we've come out of, very solid.
Mario Kanamu, thank you for giving us an update on Europe, and God bless you, and God bless Europe, and God bless America.
Thank you, and enjoy your Sunday. Take care.
Thank you. With us is Dr. William J. Parker III, Chief Executive Officer of Efficient Ships and former CEO of the East-West Institute. And he served once as chief of staff for the U.S. Navy Surface Forces. Good morning, Bill Parker. What's going on? I mean, there's so many things going on in the world. Where do you want to start?
You know, I think I think Afghanistan is where we need to start with today.
Tell us, you know, what a big mistake for us to pull out and create such a turmoil.
I'll tell you, you know, whether or not we should pull out, we could argue that point, but how you do it is really important. And guys like Dave Petraeus and Jim Stavridis know quite well that that coming out of a country is just as important as how you come into a country. And so far, we're not doing a good job at all in that latter process. You know, there's 2,300 U.S. troops that we've lost, more than that now, 300,000 trained Afghan troops. We've spent nearly $1 trillion now. And as of today, about two-thirds of the country is controlled by the Taliban, and it's quickly encircling both the airport and Kabul.
And the Chinese are moving in for those minerals that required to make car batteries, because, you know, America's giving them all the additional electric car business, so they need more materials, right?
You know, in this particular case, I think we didn't completely learn lessons from the past. You know, Alexander the Great didn't have a good time in here. The Brits didn't have a good time three times. The Russians didn't have a good time, and neither have we. That said, we did make a lot of advancements, and it is a shame to see this basically being turned over, all the natural resources, to China and others who aren't close to us in our intentions. So I'm very concerned about that.
I'm so much concerned that we spent $1 trillion. What people do is you spend $1 trillion, at least let's get some minerals or something. I mean, if they want to convert gas cars to electric cars, we need those minerals.
Absolutely, we need the minerals for the advancement of the United States, and from a moral and ethical process. You know, spent a lot of time over there, close to these people. There's a lot of good Afghani people that are going to suffer dramatically because of the way that this is ending.
Now, you were stationed originally at one time where, in Afghanistan, or was it Iraq?
I was in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan at different times over a few years.
So you've been there, so you know what's going on. I mean, what else would you like to tell the American people?
I will tell you, it's sad to see Lashkar Gah, that was controlled by the Marines for so long, so perfectly. The fact that Bagram Air Base was just turned over. You know, we could really use Bagram right now. It'd be a great way to focus. But the bottom line is the American soldiers have done an absolutely superb job over there. And it's a shame that we're exiting the way we are after all the good work that was done by the Americans and our allies.
I agree with you. I think most Americans agree with you. I mean, why doesn't the White House realize that?
It's a sad situation for sure. I mean, certainly at some point we need to stop America's longest war, but there's a right and a wrong way to do it.
We have a minute left. What would you like to tell the American people this morning?
Well, I'll tell you, beyond Afghanistan, the fact that we have 100,000 plus now coming down with coronavirus every day is something that we need to stay focused on. Mass vaccinations, other possibilities out there. But certainly we're spiking, and we need to pay attention to what's going on here in the United States as well right now. And we also need to look at what's going on in Turkey. So those are things I think we need to focus on in the years and months to come.
I understand Turkey has moved into some people into Afghanistan, too. Is that true?
That is true. They're looking at turning over control of the airport in Kabul to the Turks. So we'll see how that plays out. They certainly have a capable military, but we'll see if that works for both the Turks and for others in the future.
William J. Parker, thank you so much for everything you've done for America and continue to speak out for America. God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
Exploring the truth, telling both sides with common sense thinking. Here's John Catsimatidis on Talk Radio 77 WABC. This is the Cats Roundtable.
Good morning, America. This is the Cats Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here. It's Sunday morning. What's going on in Florida? Well, we had that very serious problem down in Miami, and people are still scratching their head over it. And today we have with us Father Aristides. Father Aristides, the presiding priest of the Greek Orthodox Church of St. Andrew in Kendall, Florida, who was the first priest on hand during the SERF problem. And also with us is Jimmy Petronis, a successful businessman, former state legislature, and now the chief financial officer of the state of Florida. And good morning. How are you, guys?
John, thank you for having us.
We're going to give Father Aristides the first go at this. Father, you were, I understand, one of the first priests on hand on SERF when the building collapsed. Tell us what happened.
I'm blessed to be part of the Miami-Dade Police Department. Mr. John is one of their chaplains, and I got a call at about 5 in the morning from my major, and the major goes, "We need you in Surfside. There was a building that collapsed." So we picked up. I got to Miami Beach within 40 minutes. And when I get there, you're breathless when you see the destruction of that collapse and you see the pain of the families. So as a first reaction, what we do as first responders is we go through chain of command. So we went through a chain of command to find out what we could do to help. And then from there on, we kicked in action.
And you must have been in shock when you got there. Tell us what your eyes saw. Tell us what you felt.
The first thing that you see is this massive building and half of it collapsed completely. And being a father myself and having two beautiful young children, you see... Because the area that collapsed were the area where the families were sleeping. So you see the cribs, you see, you know, their bedrooms, and your heart sinks. And then right next to it, right next to the area, you actually had some of the parents of the victims who were there as well. So we were trying to console them. We were just by their side and trying to listen to them and their pain. But everyone was in shock. And when you first see that kind of magnitude of destruction, it saddens you and it pains you.
And Jimmy Petronis, you are the chief financial officer of the state of Florida. Tell us about when you found out about it and the shock you have. I mean, this stuff doesn't happen every day.
No, Mr. John. I was down in Fort Lauderdale. I wear a number of hats. I'm the state's chief financial officer, so I cover a lot of insurance-related issues. But also, I'm the state fire marshal, so all the coordination of the urban search and rescue teams in the state of Florida come under our jurisdiction. So I took my children out of school, and I've got a 13-year-old, so I take him on the road with me. And I told my wife, I said, look, if I'm going to take this job and be a statewide, you know, elected official, I'm going to give my kids an experience of a lifetime. So I took my 13-year-old. We're down in Fort Lauderdale, and my phone rings at 5 in the morning. It's my chief of staff, and he says, you know, I hate to call you this early in the morning, but we had a problem. And he tells me about the building collapse, and my heart dropped. And, you know, I don't even take a shower. You know, all I had was my suit. I didn't have any other clothes with me. So I throw my suit on. A dear friend of mine took my son, my 13-year-old, and spent the day with him. And we were boots on the ground, and you get to the site. And when you walk up, initially, it looks normal because the building to the street side didn't experience any trauma. And then as you walked around the building and you saw this entire stack of concrete pancakes, because literally every floor fell on top of one another. And I, there's no way I could ever describe it. It's a set of concrete pancakes. It's each one of those balconies, you know, which each one was a floor, was on top of each other. So it was so raw, so painful. But the men were working since, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, really 1:45 in the morning, digging through rubble, doing everything he could to save lives.
Wow, I understand now. Were the people given a proposal to make repairs and they didn't do it? What's the final outcome? Don't forget, this is a nationwide broadcast, and people in the rest of the country don't know.
Sure. So to the best of my understanding, there was a homeowners association, and you understand how these work. They're like small cities. You know, you've got the tenants of the building. They're the constituents. The board of directors that gets elected is like the city council, and they usually hire a condominium association manager who might as well be the city manager. So as they are deliberating, taking care of their city, their condominium, back in 2018, they were put forward a proposal. It was a substantial number, but it was
in the
millions.
It was like a couple hundred thousand dollars for every condo owner.
So it that was what they ultimately agreed upon. So they had a smaller number back in 2018 that they had deliberated. Now, why they did not necessarily pursue those repairs back in 2018, they opted against doing it. Fast forward, Miami-Dade County has an ordinance on the books that says every 40 years you must have a full building inspection, and that building inspection must be passed. Otherwise, the building can be condemned until the necessary repairs are made. So the building was actually at its 40-year anniversary. So those inspections were taking place. So 2018, they decided not to pursue the repairs. This year, in 2021, back in the spring, they had revisited the same engineer to come out with the same inspections, and they had decided to go ahead and pursue. So they were finalizing the contract for the repairs literally the month that the building collapsed. And it was going to be an assessment of, I think, about $125,000 per owner, some of which paid them in full, some of which were going to go through a financing option that the Homeowners Association was going to afford to the owners of the units.
Understood. Now that some people paid with their lives and some people escaped, what is there any liability left for the condo board directors or the condo owners?
So a number of the different the building had lots of insurances. And matter of fact, the same insurance agent that took care of the building was their agent for a number of years. So there was a good working relationship. The condo really carried a lot of coverage. The governance in that point wasn't bad, really. But what you had a number of the carriers. They said, you know what, this is a total loss. So some of the liability coverages, the carrier just came in, just wrote the $2 million check. So what happened is immediately a judge was appointed. The judge appointed a special receiver, as an attorney with a firm down in Miami-Dade County, who then basically takes over all the accounts, the paperwork. So the moving forward liquidation of the assets is handled in a public governance under the eyes of the court.
So you're not going to have a problem where the insurance company comes in and say, well, the board of directors were wrong. They didn't do the repairs when they knew about it, and we're not going to pay.
Some of that is yet to be determined. But here's one of the problems. Buildings do not collapse in the United States. This was the third largest building collapse in the United States, only behind Oklahoma and the World Trade Center. So
in Oklahoma and the World Trade Center were bombs. This is not a bomb.
Correct. So, and the biggest threat that buildings have in the state of Florida are hurricanes.
Yes.
So the insurance policy for this particular building, the primary amount of the premiums were being paid were windstorm premiums. There's not premiums set aside for collapse, because collapses don't happen in the United States. So some of this is still yet to be unpacked. I think to date, the receiver has somewhere north of $20 million that has been accumulated through the various insurance policies that have paid out. And the judge already came out and said, which, you know, that any of the dollars that were paid through insurance policies to the homeowners associations are not eligible for any lawsuits. So basically, if individuals want to go and try to sue the contractor, the engineer, the architect, all of those are in and separate of what the homeowners will be entitled to.
Before we go back to Father Aristides, is there big investigations on other buildings that have possible problems?
Yes. So immediately, it was literally the week that this took place, the county issued a countywide inspection of all buildings that could be anywhere near 40 years old. So, you know, you can imagine the anxiety of people that are living in a building. Is my building safe?
Yes.
But, you know, but to close, I can't brag enough about the bravery and the heroism that I saw by Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, by Miami-Dade Police Department, by the city of Miami as their task forces that show up, and all the other six other task forces from around the state that joined. We had as many people working on a one-acre site for over 3 weeks, 12-hour shifts at a time, 24 hours a day, working on a one-acre site as we had with 12 counties affected by Hurricane Michael. So, I mean, it was just a massive humanitarian rescue effort. And Father Aristides was there. Every day I was there, he was there. He was comforting people. He was holding people's hands.
Jim Petronis, you know, we're running out of time. I hope you come back as you get new information. I hope you call WABC Radio and come back and give us some additional information. And Father Aristides, I feel your pain being there, and I can understand the pain you felt knowing that for sure there was people that lost their lives in that building. Tell us.
So it was painful to see the collapse, and it was painful to see the pain that the parents and the relatives are there. But, you know, they always had the hope. So we our purpose as first responders was just to strengthen them.
Father Aristides, thank you so much. And Jimmy Petronis, thank you so much for what you do for all the people of Miami and the people of Florida. God bless you all, and we'll catch up again real soon. And God bless Miami, and God bless America.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable every Sunday morning. We'll bring you the latest in what's happening in our community, our country, and the world. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have a nice Sunday.